In the fictional town of Blacksmith, Jack Gladney has built his academic reputation as North America's foremost Hitler scholar, despite not speaking German. This professional insecurity mirrors his deeper fear, death. Jack shares this existential dread with his fourth wife, Babette, as they preside over their blended household of children from various marriages. There's Heinrich, Jack's intellectually precocious 14-year-old, Denise, Babette's vigilant 11-year-old who monitors her mother's health habits like a miniature FDA agent, sensitive Steffi, and toddler Wilder, whose pre-linguistic existence represents a purer form of being. Their home buzzes with the white noise of modern life. Television chatter, radio announcements, kitchen debates about camels and environmental toxins. These ordinary family dynamics reveal how deeply information anxiety has penetrated everyday existence. Jack and Babette frequently ask each other, "Who will die first?" A question that moves beyond theoretical when Jack is exposed to a mysterious chemical during an environmental disaster. Their approaches to mortality, Jack's academic immersion in Hitler, Babette's secret participation in an experimental drug trial, show how profoundly death anxiety shapes their identities and choices. It seemed to me that Babette and I, in the mass and variety of our purchases, in the sheer plenitude those crowded bags suggested, were creating a sense of replenishment. I began to grow in value and self-regard. The supermarket functions as a quasi-religious space where the Gladneys seek meaning. Shopping trips take on spiritual dimensions, with colorful packages promising fulfillment as shoppers move in secular communion. When Jack meets colleague Murray there, Murray observes, "This place recharges us spiritually. It prepares us. It's a gateway. Look how bright. It's full of psychic data." This consumer cathedral provides what religion once did: community, ritual, and transcendence. After the toxic evacuation, Jack finds comfort in the supermarket's musical brightness amid town decay. Yet this comfort brings disconnection from authentic experience and inability to face mortality. In one scene, the family eats fast food in their car with primal concentration, half stunned by the dimensions of our pleasure, revealing both the power and limitations of consumer culture as meaning. White noise captures the disorienting effect of constant media exposure, where reality becomes inseparable from its representation. Television, radio, tabloid headlines, and academic jargon blend to create the titular background hum of modern existence. The Gladney family's relationship with television is telling. Babette institutes mandatory Friday viewing to de-glamorize the medium. Yet when they see Babette herself on television, they experience existential disorientation. She exists simultaneously in the room and on screen. Only toddler Wilder remains calm, touching her image while others struggle with this technological separation. During the toxic chemical spill, shifting symptoms and danger levels leave characters uncertain what to believe. When a plane nearly crashes, Jack's daughter immediately asks where the cameras are. Without media attention, disasters seem less real. At the most photographed barn in America, Murray observes tourists can't experience it directly. "We're not here to capture an image, we're here to maintain one. We can't get outside the aura." Reality becomes filtered through layers of representation that both enhance and diminish experience. When a chemical spill creates a toxic cloud, officially an airborne toxic event, abstract fears become concrete. The evacuation unfolds with cinematic intensity. Families wrapped in plastic move with fated determination, giving them an epic quality, like people trekking across wasted landscapes. The cloud looms, like some death ship in a Norse legend, inspiring awe that bordered on the religious. Heinrich, typically moody, becomes surprisingly animated during the crisis, describing every detail with spirited enjoyment, revealing how disaster can perversely excite, breaking through numbing routines. The official response exemplifies satire when Simulvac personnel use the real toxic event as practice for future simulations, inverting preparation and reality. Symptoms evolve chaotically, from sweaty palms to convulsions, coma, miscarriage, creating both comedy and anxiety. For Jack, disaster becomes personal after exposure to Niodine D creates a nebulous mass in his body with no definite shape, form, or limits. This abstract death sentence drives increasingly desperate actions as he confronts mortality. Death's terror haunts Jack and Babette intimately, their question, who will die first, becoming woven into the texture of the bedroom, a natural part of the night thoughts. Both develop shields against mortality. Jack immerses himself in Hitler studies, using the dictator's overwhelming historical presence as protection. Babette secretly joins a trial for Dialer, a drug designed to eliminate death anxiety, trading sexual favors with researcher Mr. Gray for access. When Jack discovers this, he plots to kill Gray and steal the drug. His colleague Murray justifies this. There are killers and dyers, and killing transfers death to another. Researcher Winnie Richards counters, "I think it's a mistake to lose one's sense of death. Doesn't it give a precious texture to life?" Meanwhile, atheist German nuns maintain religious practices without belief. Sister Hermann Marie explains, "The non-believers need the believers. Our pretense is a dedication," suggesting modern life requires various forms of pretense to manage existential dread. White Noise discovers both comedy and transcendence in the mundane, where ordinary reality reveals something mysterious. Family conversations oscillate between profound topics and trivialities. When Jack and Babette discuss pleasing each other sexually, their circular dialogue, "I want to do whatever's best for you," captures both the absurdity and tenderness of intimacy. Babette objects to phrases like "he entered her" in erotic literature because we're not lobbies or elevators, a line both humorous and philosophically astute. Comedy persists even during crisis. During evacuation, Jack notices people shopping for furniture while others flee and wonders, why were they content to shop while we sat panicky in slow-poke traffic in a snowstorm? They knew something we didn't. This highlights the absurdity of consumer behavior during disaster. The novel finds beauty in unexpected places. Wilder's crying becomes almost transcendent. "I let it wash over me like rain in sheets." Jack's ATM transaction transforms into spiritual connection. The system had blessed my life. Despite its dark themes, White Noise affirms the possibility of genuine experience in a world mediated by technology, consumerism, and academic jargon. Throughout the novel, moments of authentic connection break through the static of modern life. Children often serve as conduits for unfiltered experience. Wilder, who barely speaks, represents a pre-linguistic relationship with reality. His tricycle journey across the expressway becomes a heroic quest, ending with an almost religious rescue by a motorist. Steffi provides another moment when Jack hears her sleeping murmur, "Toyota Celica," an advertising phrase that becomes, in her unconscious utterance, beautiful and mysterious, gold shot with looming wonder. Even the supermarket offers connection. In the novel's final scene, amid the disorientation of rearranged shelves, checkout scanners decode the binary secret of every item in the language of waves and radiation. In a world where death anxiety underlies daily routines and media distorts perception, the capacity for wonder persists. Finding meaning within the white noise may reveal what it means to be fully human.